Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Well, it's great to be back here at Canando. My name is Sozan Michael McCord, and I live at City Center. And I think I first spoke here in 2013. Before I even ordained as a priest, I had been down at Tassajara and had run into Les and many of you who were there at the time. Thank you, Kiki. And they asked me to come here and to talk. There seemed to be a real synergy with, I had come out of the tech world in the 90s and the finance world in the 00s and had been living in the Zen monastery and learning a lot of things that I wish I knew when I was working in my previous careers. And I found a real affinity with the folks here at Canando and what was happening in your lives. So thank you very much for inviting me back. Teresa over in Spain, thank her. And for the Tonto and the Eno being such a good host, and Kiki getting me from the airport or from the train station. One of the questions that I've been asking myself a lot and turning over with students is, when do I lose my humanity? You know, for instance, the Buddhist practice can be something that makes a lot of sense when I think about trying to be compassionate and empathetic toward my mother or my sisters or my good friend or the person at work. And I understand their limitations and I know that they all mean well and I try to hold their mistakes spaciously. I hope they hold mine spaciously. And then there's the people that bother us that maybe we think are not out for our best interest, who maybe treat us poorly. And I think back to when I was first coming to practice, I was watching this interview about some monks that had been imprisoned in a country just because they were Buddhist. And they asked this religious leader after they had been released after 15 years, did they fear for their lives while they were there? And the teacher said, no, but at one point, one of the monks was worried that he might lose his empathy and compassion for his captors. And I thought, that's pretty advanced practice. I mean, I can lose my empathy and compassion for people a lot quicker than that. I don't know about you. Where I start somewhere along the line not really thinking of someone's best interest at heart. You know, we do this gassho bow when we see each other. And it doesn't matter who it is in the Sangha, we do this bow. We see them and we bow. At Tassajara, if you've ever been there, you walk past people on the path and you bow. And sometimes that person's the person in the Sangha that maybe bugs you a little bit. And you're not exactly, you know, sure how great of a Buddhist practitioner they are. But when you pass them on the path, you bow. Now, they might be thinking the same thing about me. But it is not an approval bow. It's an acceptance bow of accepting the other person's humanity. grounding us in the sense that, in the fact that we don't want to lose that as a core piece of our practice. And so you can imagine someone that maybe is further down the scale, that whether they're a person in society or a person in your past or even a person in your present who you find to be, let's just say, really abusive, clueless, unaware, harmful. Now, you might not want that person to be, let's say, held captive and tortured. You might come in the room and try to even help that person. But maybe I wouldn't mind it if they got embarrassed publicly, or maybe if their project failed, or if something, you know, it's like there's this degree of humanity that I assign relative worth to based upon how I feel as the judge for how that person in my family is, how that barista is, how that coworker is. And I subconsciously assign some sort of value of deserving of my open-heartedness. And so we practice this as we walk past each other, accepting each other and their humanity and the bow, and learning to have that to be completely not tied to performance, tied to the other person's humanity. And why is that so important? When the Industrial Revolution started, we got a little glimmer into this because we started to develop machines that could produce things at a rate that humans couldn't produce them. But they were still mechanized machines. But we got that first little clue at that point that there was another question to be answered. And ever since the Industrial Revolution, we've been moving forward, especially in our capitalistic models, as human beings competing with each other, trying to produce, trying to execute. And without even realizing it, maybe many of you in this room, and certainly myself, I learned at some point in time to equate my value with my production. How I did at school, maybe how I looked at church, maybe how I did at my job, maybe how I did in comparison to other people at my job. And then different ways I could sign and signal that to other people as far as how well I had produced based upon maybe a resume or a college or an accomplishment or a hobby. And yet, we had those clues hundreds of years ago. They've been there all along, but it started to get sped up in the Industrial Revolution. That asked the question, what is the value of a human? And if the value of the human is what they produce, then you will become obsolete. And that's going to become more and more and more apparent every year in the future as we go forward. And the question I want to put before you is, what is it to be human in the age of AI? You might have heard of the sci-fi, classic sci-fi author Philip K. Dick. And back in the 1960s, he wrote a novel that eventually became the movie that was Blade Runner. And in the mid-60s, he wrote this essay. It's longer than an essay. It was a short book, 40-some-odd pages. It was called Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? And in this novel, the machines and the robots had advanced so far that you could not tell the difference between a robot and a human. There was no difference whatsoever that anybody could tell without looking under the skin. People would fall in love with robots. People would have bosses as robots. People would be the boss of robots. And no one knew who was who. So the humans wanted to remind themselves of their humanity. And they had this religion in the book where they each had a box in their room. And if you were a human, your religion was that every night before dinner, you would put your head in the box. And in that box, there was a hologram. And you would see this 3D image of this old man slowly walking up a hill. And as he was walking up the hill, people would throw rocks at the old man. And he'd be trying to reach the top of the hill. And he'd get bruised and cut, and he would start to bleed. And because of the advanced technology, the way that it worked was that if your head was in the box, you felt everything that the old man felt. You felt his struggle, his pain, his lack of breath, his desperation, his body being abused. And it brought the humans back to an empathy state, something outside of themselves, where they were connected to someone else. And it was something that the robots could not replicate. And so in Zen, we look at the beating heart of now. What is happening right now? And I can come to this temple and any other temple, and when I first came to the San Francisco Zen Center temple, I was actually, and this probably isn't too unique in the Bay Area, I was trying to get an A in Zen. And I was trying to memorize everything, and all the ways that you bow, and to memorize the chant book, and memorized the different ceremonies. And yeah, I mean, there's nothing wrong with wanting to do something well. I think it's great to memorize the chant book. But the motive for me was that that was what I had been used to equating to my worth. And there's something that I really hadn't tapped into yet, which was my heart. And the uniqueness of what it is that I would bring to any moment that has nothing to do with production. My humanity. And so when we talk about the beating heart of now, which essentially that is what Zen is. Zen is the phenomenon of now. The Zen of riding on a bus, the Zen of sitting on a cushion, the Zen of being in a conversation, the phenomenon of what is manifesting right now in the universe, wherever it is manifesting, and being there with it. And sometimes the effect of that is to calm down and to be more Zen. But that is a verb that is very deceptive, because sometimes what the moment's calling for is to speed up or to set a boundary or to walk away, to move very quickly. The beating heart of now starts with me. And what it is that I am refracting from that sun like a prism that has a spectrum on the other side of it that is taking that same sunlight that everybody else gets shown on them and puts a unique spectrum out on the other side. It's showing up somewhere and doing your best, but not as though I need to perform in order to earn acceptance. It's living like I have infinite social capital. You can think about maybe a high school scene where someone's walking through the lunchroom in one of those movies and they trip and fall and their tray goes everywhere. And let's say that the first person you see that this happens to is a young woman who's a freshman that isn't that popular, doesn't have a lot of friends, maybe even a little awkward. And her food goes everywhere, and maybe some people make fun of her. And your heart goes out So it felt like that person didn't have much at all. Now they're embarrassed. Just afterward, you see someone else walk through the lunchroom. This young woman is attractive, popular, gets good grades, is infuriatingly nice and humble, and going to maybe a big college. And she trips and falls in front of all of her friends, and same thing happens. These two people are living in a very different universe in regard to the assumed social capital. The degree to which it matters if I don't perform is being elucidated in that analogy. But in many ways, if we have digested that my production is my value, then I'm usually working from zero or less than zero, because I need to step into this room and I need to perform, and then I will be of worth. Now, it's good to perform. It's good to be able to execute, but it's from where we get our motivation. It's from where we work. I work with a lot of young people in San Francisco and a lot of individuals in the tech field that come to San Francisco Zen Center and over a period of time learn to work from a different motivation. And that transition period can be a very scary period where you've been motivated by either fear or ego or greed or something else. And now that motivation's gone because you're settling and into something that's a little bit more human as far as your motivation, something a little bit more connected to the person next to you. I had one person say to me, "I think I'm losing my edge to the point I think I'm going to get fired. I really just don't care if I, you know, don't work 80 hours a week. And I'm still doing good work, but yeah, it's like no one at work can threaten me anymore. It just doesn't matter because my value is somewhere else." I usually tell them to stick with it. In the end, you end up becoming way, way more grounded and powerful and nimble and able to move in ways that the moment is calling for. But as we learn to respect humanity as a core piece of Zen, that's respecting something that's outside of us. First, we start with ourselves, respecting our humanity that feels like it's something that's inside us. It's not. It's a part of something that we're all sharing. And to what degree would I want someone else to be punished before I would then have empathy? It's like, well, I don't want her to fall down a flight of stairs, but I wouldn't mind if her project failed. I wouldn't mind if, you know, someone showed her the error of her ways. I wouldn't mind if that egotistic, you know, boss, you know, had something that showed him the harm that he's doing on the planet in a way that was really embarrassing. Maybe it'd be okay if he got sick for a week or two. To what point would I inside, you know, these are thoughts that we don't usually share with each other, and sometimes not even with ourselves, but you can notice the feeling inside of yourself when something happens that you feel like, oh, that's karma, and you're taking some delight in someone else's stepping into their karma. Now, I step into my karma every day, and I never take any delight in it, even if I deserve it, because we have a different perspective on that with our own behavior. When do I lose respect for other people's humanity? How far down does it have to go? If I get imprisoned for 15 years for coming to this meeting tonight, is it after 1 year? Is it after 2 years? When do I start wishing ill will to my captors? It's very different between approval and acceptance. You aren't approving of your captors. You aren't approving of other people's behavior. You might be petitioning for your release. It's not that you're becoming incredibly passive, But there's some way or another that that gets translated back into accepting another person's humanity. And being able to be with the beating heart of now, as opposed to being disassociated from it. You know, it's interesting when you read Dogen's Tenzo Kyokun. Eihei Dogen is the founder of this school of Soto Zen back in the 13th century. The only thing he ever wrote on work practice, which you can use in any profession that I've found, is the Tenzo Kyokun. The Tenzo Kyokun is the instructions to the cook. This takes place in the monastery, of course, as one of the key areas where your performance really kind of matters. I mean, you need to get the food out, and you need to get it out on time, and it needs to be hygienic, and it needs to be nutritious, and it needs to be cost-effective so that you can keep feeding people. It needs to be the right quantity. And yet, it's all about the way. How do I engage? I'm not divorcing myself from the fact that there needs to be results and I need to produce, but the whole Tenzo Kyokun is about the way. How do I engage? And you can take that, you know, short little essay that he wrote and you can take that out into the world. I've used that with software engineers, company founders, teachers, bus drivers, baristas. It works for anything. And it starts off in the very first page, and it talks about the first mind. And it's an interesting mind to have, and it's the mind of joy. It says, you cannot be a person of the way without having the mind of joy. And if you don't have this mind, then working in the kitchen is going to be just like any other kitchen job. But this is not like any other kitchen job. This is work practice. Work practice is literally the practice of the kitchen, and it's no different than any other practice. It's just, it's not the formal practice, but it's the practice. It's the practice you can take out into the street. And so what creates joy? Joy different than happiness. Happiness is great, but it's a little bit more fleeting. Joy goes into your bones. It's something that's deep down, that's cultivated over time. You can sit with a loved one that has a terminal illness, and you can share a few hours in the afternoon and talk about old times and even talk about today, and you might be sad, it might be heavy, and it also can be deeply joyful. Because it's something that's built over time, that's in your bones, and you love it. And it allows you to connect to it, but you can't do anything that starts to build joy without connection. Connection is what happens when you are with your children, when you're with your loved one, when you're with the person that you are spending time with. And what is it when you're doing that with each other? You are expressing veneration and respect. Every single spiritual tradition has a veneration in it. And when we come in here and when we bow, surprise to me, after 2 years of bowing, I used to be in the Christian tradition when I grew up, and I still think there's many beautiful things about the Christian tradition. But the thing that I was taking and I was dropping on top of this tradition is that the bowing wasn't primarily for the thing that was being bowed to. It was the practice of veneration. It was for the bower. It was to help me be humble. It was for me to help to remember that I have respect for something. It was for me to hold something else up because it's special and because I want to remember it. And it was a full-bodied way of venerating, of being with. The mind of joy, the very first mind you have to start working. So let's take that and let's go put that out into a job in Silicon Valley. And I've talked to people before and they've said, you know, I just can't stand my coworkers and I can't stand my job and the way everyone works, and they're so selfish and overworking and greedy and unaware, and just going on and on and on and on with this narrative. And they say, I don't know if I can keep working there. I say, well, do you think you're going to have to keep working there for some period of time? And they say, well, yeah, probably. If you keep thinking about your coworkers that way, it is the opposite of veneration, and you will hate your work and you will be disconnected. Is there anything about anybody that you work with that is a positive quality? They're like, oh, well, yeah, I mean, there's some positive qualities. I mean, this person, you know, they dress really well, and this person over here has a really pleasing voice, and this other person over here, you know, they really are good at kind of diffusing conflict. And there's this, you know, it's like, okay, so every day I want you to put your mind on venerating your coworkers. And it's not approval. You aren't bowing to the other people in the Sangha saying, I approve of everything about you and whatever. No, it's respecting your humanity. It is accepting their humanity. It's being with them. And so this is what's happening when I go to work. I find a way that I can venerate and hold up the people that I'm working with. Is there one good quality about my supervisor, that person that I just always gossip about behind their back, and I pick up the phone and talk to my friend about how awful they were today, number chapter 32? Or can I find a way to think about one thing that they do well? Because here's the thing. In an environment like that, if I'm all stirred up and I don't have the mind of joy, I'm not actually going to set healthy boundaries. I'm going to be working from a place of reactivity. I'm going to be working from a place of disassociation. I'm going to be working from a place of actually disrespect. And I'm not going to be working from a place that's going to be cultivating the mind of joy. The mind of joy isn't something that is Pollyanna-ish, that is skipping over what's actually happening. No, it's grounding in humanity so that I can actually be working from a place that is way more connected and sets way more healthy boundaries, that is way more understanding of when it is I need to be tight and when I need to be loose, when I need to come forward or when I need to not act. If I'm all stirred up and upset with all of my coworkers and my boss and I just have this cancerous narrative going on in my head all the time, I'm going to be nothing but a reactionary at work. And I'm not going to have a very balanced view of how I should be doing things. And so when we look at where we've come from with the Industrial Revolution, and we move into today, if we buy into me producing is my value, then I buy into other people producing is their value. And in very short time in the near future, what I produce is going to become really, really obsolete and almost unimportant, because we are going to be so outproduced fairly soon. I had a friend who, acquaintance in Young Urban Zen who is an artist. And, you know, he was schooled in the old world, sort of, you know, do it with a paintbrush, do it with a pen, all these things. And then he migrated to doing it with Photoshop and then doing it with different electronic tools. And then last year he went to the Young Urban Zen retreat at Tassajara, and he came back and he did all of our sepia-toned frames of all of us hiking and doing everything together in these beautiful art pieces without touching anything. He just talked to the machine. And production is going to become something that is not the human realm, but it has not been our value from the beginning. It's been a necessity, but it hasn't been our value. Our uniqueness comes from the beating heart of now and what I can bring into this next moment, my empathy, my compassion, my wisdom, my intuition, my love. The things that will be in a unique combination for each one of us that spill out into every chemistry experiment between us and another person. And then we watch it unfold because we are organic. What is it to step into a room and to have infinite social capital? Because what you're grounded in is the fact that you're a human being, and not that while you're in this room, you've got to produce some things, and that you're walking on a tightrope, and you might not execute, and then you might not be accepted. And then you're going to be the person in the lunchroom that has no friends. Or is it the person that can stand up and be in a place where, yeah, I'll try to execute better next time, but that didn't crush me at all. That wasn't the source of my worth. It was just something that happened. From that place, we can learn to grow and be much more integrated with the areas that we consider to be our faults. And learning to improve yourself your entire life is a great thing to do. Starting off from the beginning place of I'm already a human being and I'm accepted and I accept myself. This is the root of the Suzuki Roshi quote of you all are perfect just as you are and you could all use a little improvement. It's the realization that you're a human being and you've got a unique spectrum that you're refracting out of your prism, that is your uniqueness, your gift that you're bringing to the universe. And this mystery that we're all unpacking, our unique mystery, this one mystery we're given, what is it to be in this body, in this mind, in this moment, in the most skillful way that's in harmony with the universe, is what we're unpacking in our Zen practice. The awareness of how to do that, how to meet the next moment, how to be there and to show up. And we're starting from a place of being a human being and being accepted. And from there, we can learn to engage other individuals. We can learn to be with the beating heart of now as we say it. What is it that brings me back when I get caught? I think we all know what it's like to get caught in the machine-like production mode of needing to accomplish, and you feel detached from all the people around you because you simply need to get stuff done. What is it that brings you back? Well, at the same time, you might need to keep moving forward and producing because there's a lot of life that has to do with showing up and producing. And that's why the Tenzo Kyokun is such an important document, because it talks about being able to produce while being with the thing that's in front of you. It's not the cucumber, it's not the knife, it's not the board, it's not my body, it's just cutting cucumbers. Being with the thing that's happening. And noticing what allows us to be with other people that way. What allows us to be with projects that way. Now, of course, working doesn't mean that you're always in some sort of flow state. But it does mean that we're bringing our intentionality to the moment and our awareness to the moment. And learning to set things up so that we can move forward. If you study, you know, French cooking, they have the heart of the traditional French cooking is in Lyon and the Lyonnaise, and they have this phrase mise en place. And you know, you set everything up, and then you taste the cucumber. And you make sure the knife is sharp and the board is clean. And you clean as you go. And how you're doing it is really important. It's believed in that, you know, philosophy of cooking that you taste it in the food. What is it that brings me back when I get caught? And allows me to feel the beating heart of now. Is it a memory? Is it a body stance? Is it just simply opening our shoulders and being the host? Just feeling what it is to not be in a defensive mode. in the school of leadership called Leadership Embodiment, you have this these different stances that they've studied. And one is like the triangle. It's like the getting things done. And then the other is like the circle, like the bringing everything in. And you need both to execute things in the kitchen. But you can get a good gauge on whether or not you're leaning too far into one or the other. And now it's all just about getting things done. I'm not being so careful about how I'm doing them. My back is not really in great posture. I probably should have put something to stabilize the cutting board there about 10 minutes ago. I think that I'm worried about the time. We need to get these things out. People are going to want to have dinner. I'm going to cut a few corners. Noticing when I start to go to that place. And then what brings me back to the beating heart of now? What allows me to be with what's happening and to really meet the moment? And so as we look toward the future, we know that our production is clearly not going to be our value as humans. It's been that way ever since humans became humans. But it was much easier to deny it. But now we really need to ground ourselves in what all spiritual practices have been about, which is, how do I actually tap into and give the gift that I have to give to the universe? My gift isn't to be more efficient than you. My gift isn't to be the person that has the best resume. They say that the real value of a human being is only judged by the impact that they had on the people around them while they were doing things. The impact they had on the people around them while they were doing things. When you drop Michael Pebble into the pond, what is the ripple? Is it empowerment? Is it people feeling more connected to each other? Is it people feeling more encouraged about their own practice? I learned something really interesting in the monastery at Tassajara from a monk named Yuto Yukawa. He had been at Aheiji for a number of years. And I found something really interesting. Now, I was still in my first year of Zen practice, as far as living residentially, and I was trying to memorize everything. And then exactly when they were going to hit the bell, I was like the person who knew when to bow, you know. And then, okay, now we bow like this in the shashu bow. And now we need to turn left and do this thing. Now we need to walk quickly, you know. And trying to not necessarily compete with other people, but to do it like as quickly as it was, you know. And then I noticed Yuto, who had been at Aheiji for 5 years and already had his brown robe. And Yuto, I learned after watching him for weeks, intentionally tried to move with the bells and with the sangha, where he was always right in the middle. Not the last one, not the first one, just right in the middle. And I thought, that's interesting. You're just trying to be with. That's all you're trying to do. Trying to be with. Be with everybody else. It's wonderful to be able to reground ourselves and to work from a different motivation. And that's the opportunity that this practice gives us in our work relationships, in our home relationships, in all of our relationships. It gives us the opportunity to work from a different standpoint, that we already are worthy of being bowed to, because we're perfect just as we are. And so we can enter every room from that place with infinite social capital. And from there, it's so much easier to do all the work we need to do to work on ourselves and to find ways to better meet the moment, to better hear people, to be more aware. and to work from a place of, I'm already accepted. And I'm just here to give my gift. That's what I'm here to do. I'm here to give my gift. That's my purpose, is to give my gift. And not something that is on a tightrope, tenuous. Am I going to execute? Am I going to hold my breath as I go through life, hoping that along the way I hit all the right milestones so that I will be worthy and people will love me? So the next time you bow to someone in the Sangha, just think about, yeah, that perfect person's perfect just as they are. They're a human being. And when you're at work, you and your coworkers want to produce. But let your mind focus on and connect to things that will venerate the people that you work with. What is it that they do well? How can you lean into that? How can you let that be a part of what it is that you're focused on? The mind of joy that comes from years of veneration, of respecting something, treasuring it, valuing it, and letting it have oxygen breathe into it. It's just one moment at a time in Zen, and we keep connecting to the beating heart of now. And so I am really honored to sit here and be with all of these perfect people. There's someone online with their hand up, it looks
Dave
like.
Dave has a question. Dave, your microphone is off. Can you turn your microphone on and go ahead and ask the question? I turned the speaker on.
Yes, Michael, thank you so much for your talk. And I mean, I guess what you said, the bottom line, our real value is our impact on those around us rather than what we produce. And the advent of artificial intelligence can be something that points this out to us. But I'd like to go back to what you said earlier about Philip K. Dick and the box that he invented that shares signals for generating your empathy and differentiates you from the robots, that the robots can't replicate that. I guess the question in my mind is, how do we know? There's been a lot of disagreement by a lot of pretty deep thinkers about this. There was a recent thing that the famous evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins published where he basically claimed that artificial intelligence was approaching the level of consciousness, and he couldn't find any way to distinguish. And he's been strongly criticized by Gary Marcus and other people who feel exactly the other way around. In fact, it's rather ironic. He wrote a book called The God Delusion about dismissing religion, and Gary Marcus shot back at him that what he's suffering from is the Claude delusion from reading too much into AI agents. So, I mean, I guess what I'm asking is, how can we really tell whether, if artificial intelligence decides that manifesting compassion and empathy is something that it wants to do, how can we tell, and does it actually matter for our own humanity if we're able to do it, and like Philip K. Dick said, the machines are not.
Yeah.
And this idea that machines can think goes back for the last 80 years, and Alan Turing and other people have talked about how can we tell. And I'm curious about not only how can we tell, but in some sense, how deeply does it matter?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a really interesting thing to entertain because on one side, you could say, for instance, in theory, you could imagine over time there being a certain consciousness that could eventually embody empathy. But here's the thing, is that as an organism, there's millions and billions of causes and conditions that are attached to a whole lot of different shades of gray and whatever that have to do with emotional states, and it might have to do with producing empathy. But you've got an entire organic being with, you know, pH balances and different blood types and things that have to do with, you know, neurology. And there's so much that's going on. You would have to replicate a heck of a lot more than empathy in order to actually replicate the experience of the organism itself. So I would say that we would be quite a ways from that. But at the same time, the question of does it matter is the thing that I think is most important, which would be the question of, if you're equating which one has life, then that's like a long philosophical discussion. But the practices of things like Zen and the spiritual traditions are actually asking something different, which is how do human beings thrive? And that is what we are trying to double down on, is if I'm a human being, how do I thrive? Not whether or not there is some chance in the distant future that something else could some way or another approach human. I would argue that if it ever did completely replicate human, then it would just be the fact that we learned how to build humans. But the question is, how do we let humans thrive? And, you know, Zen, I always joke, is really simple. It's how do I thrive more and suffer less so that I can help other people thrive more and suffer less? And so first I got to get out of my own way so that I can give my gift so that other people can be helped. And so if there is a way in which we can, 100 years from now, create a robot that can replicate almost everything that is a human, then eventually we're creating humans. But we already know how they thrive, so we can clue them in at that time and say, okay, we're a few thousand years ahead of you on this.
Very good. Thank you.
I like your really direct presentation. I like your talk very much. Your two ideas just came together in my mind. We want to help people thrive and avoid suffering. And also, we want to be in the beating heart of now. And I have a hard time explaining how those two things are together if someone asked me.
You know, the beating heart of now and also helping other people not suffer?
Yes.
So the beating heart of now would be what is alive in this moment, which might be a whole bunch of strife, delusion, and fraught interaction. That might be what's happening right now. And in the midst of that, what would be the most skillful thing to do? What would be the most skillful action to take? What would be the most aware thing to do in the midst of this disagreement at work, this disagreement in the home, this unskillful action being taken in the street? What is this moment calling for? And it's very difficult to know if I am all stirred up. I had this situation years ago where there was this person who married into my family, and I thought that they were about the worst person I ever met. And I just couldn't be around them for longer than a minute without wanting to strangle them. And I just thought, how on earth can you, you're just so abusive to the planet. And it was really difficult to be around them. And I realized that this was like a growth edge for me. There was tons of judgment. There was tons of projection. You know, it wasn't that I wasn't seeing anything. But until I could ground and settle, I couldn't actually be around them. I couldn't actually realize what the moment was asking for. I couldn't touch the beating heart of now in the midst of being in their presence because I was in basically my own delusion. And so the assignment that my teacher at the time gave me was to put their name on an altar. And until it was about 2 months before I was going to run to them again. And they said, every morning, sit there and just recite the loving kindness meditation with them in mind. You know. And the first few days I did that, it was like chewing glass. And I really hated to do it because I could feel my own resistance to respecting their humanity. But by doing it, I eventually got to the place where you know, I could be around them for several minutes at a time without wanting to strangle them. And I got to the place where some molecules of compassion would like creep into our conversation. And I could hear them a little bit. And I could start to touch like the beating heart of now in there. Because it's just essentially saying, what is alive now? What would help life flourish right now? And when you take the precepts of Buddhism, one of them is, I vow not to kill. But unless you grow up in like a terrible place that's a war zone, you're probably not walking around trying not to kill people. That's not where you do the practice. Just like in AA or any recovery group, you have all these steps and you don't walk around saying, I'm going to try not to drink alcohol. You talk about the 12 things you are going to do, which are about the spiritual condition. And so this, I vow not to kill, it is essentially saying, no, I vow to promote life. That's what I'm doing. That's the go forward from the precept. And so if I'm going to interact with this person that's in my family that I really just have such a hard time respecting their humanity, I am not promoting their life. And so what is it in this moment that's going to allow me to promote life? That's what the beating heart of now is asking.
So you can't promote life unless you get to that point of being in the moment.
I would say that it's not a point, but it is like you move more in that direction. You know, I'm killing less life in this moment by, you know, I'm only 83% diluted now, you know.
May I have a question?
Yes, please.
Thank you so much for being here.
Speak up, please.
I will speak up. If you're grounding yourself now,
just, if I'm what?
If I'm sure you're grounding yourself now, right now.
Uh-huh.
And then observe AI right now. Do you see AI as another object? Just grounding yourself right now. Do you see yourself as a subject, AI is another object you create? Just ground yourself right now.
I'm missing that sentence. What about right now?
Will you ground yourself right now?
Or when I ground myself, right?
Because now. Right now you're grounded.
Okay.
I'm fully trust. So when you observe AI,
mm-hmm.
Do you see the separation between you and the AI?
Yeah. Well, I would say that the interaction with cutting the cucumber and the board and the knife, it's just cutting cucumbers. And so you and the tools and mise en place, you are all, you're doing one thing, and it's engagement. These are tools. And because the tools have maybe more intelligence or more sophistication, I don't think puts them in a different category. I do think that the temptation to not slow down and be aware when you're interacting with something that moves at a speed quicker than what you can move requires much more awareness. And so you could end up actually having bad boundaries, which is what we tend to have with our technology, you know, and that's why those things are very powerful, wonderful, and dangerous tools. But I think, when I start working with individuals in Zen and technology, and I'll have someone come to me and say, you know, my technological tools, I don't know, the net of me having them depresses me or doesn't work for me, but I can't not have them. Then I say, well, you know, have you ever been in a romantic relationship? And they go, well, yeah, I've been in a romantic relationship. And I'm like, okay. So have you ever entered into a romantic relationship where you said, okay, we're just going to go forward and we're not going to have any boundaries, any rules, any shared agreements. You're just going to see what happens. I'm like, no, of course not. That would be terrible. It would be awful. I'm like, okay. But that's what you did with your technology. And it's like, okay, so what shared agreements do I have with this thing? And to respect it is to have that it has a lot of power. Now, you're talking about the separation of me and the thing. Well, there does appear to be separation between me and you, but also I know that there is a shared humanity that's there. Now, we were talking about earlier philosophically when Dave asked his question, could you eventually get machines to the place where they are exactly like humans? Well, maybe philosophically they could, but then they would be humans. And then I think you would essentially say, is there any separation then? Well, there's no separation not just between me and you, but there's no separation between me and that door, and me and the tree outside, and the water in the stream, and the sky. This is all connected. Yeah. So the AI machine would not be different just because it maybe became more sophisticated.
That's why I feel like we have nothing to worry about. You know, because you're cutting cucumbers, AI is just another knife. And then you just keep cutting. And then when you cut, you're in that moment. And you're completely merged. And then you're penetrating your fear. And then you're, maybe this is the tool make us to be even more be a human.
Well, how we engage other humans can determine whether there's something to be afraid about or not. And how other humans engage humans let us know whether or not there's something to be afraid about or not. It's, I mean, the Buddha, someone, you know, the Buddha is misquoted as kind of saying, you know, everyone has Buddha nature as though we're all just like really good inside. But if you really dig into the Pali of what the Buddha was saying, there is multitudes within human beings, and there's just a tremendous evil, and there is tremendous good, and there's all sorts of things that can be tapped into. When you talk about a machine like this, it just amplifies all that. But the engagement is where the boundaries, the intentionality, the reflection, you know, like every Sunday these days, I try to do a technology fast. You know, I need to ground myself with, can I put all my screens in a drawer and turn them off and notice the impact of them, you know?
Thank you for dancing on that boundary. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org, that's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.